This is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti, on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Okay, today, in two parts, is Noam Chomsky on neoliberalism, also known as corporatism, trilateralism, goes by many names, but it's still a major problem. So it's multinational corporations running the world and politicians helping them along. There's also fascism would be another word. So that's coming up here, but first a commentary by me. And so just something I've noticed, this is my own analogy, please use your own brain at all times and practice critical thinking when listening to any media. I noticed Putin, I'm calling him Mr. Freeze right now because we're seeing Europe slowly freeze over. And another analogy is that he is very much like a dictator that that corporations install in a banana republic to extract resources, only on a grander scale. But we've had designs on his area Eastern resources, Eastern Europe resources, for many, many years. And what happens with these dictators is suddenly they decide, oh, maybe I better start giving something instead of just extracting everything and giving it to multinational corporations. Maybe I should give a little bit to the people, and because they're probably going to string me up. So when they start doing that, then all of a sudden they're deposed. And usually with a CIA coup. So, when you go home to your families and everything and try to talk to a conservative, that's an analogy, and a very imperfect analogy, I admit, but that's kind of what he is a very much like a dictator that we've installed for extracting resources. That has gone awry. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Support independent media. Okay, so what this is Noam Chomsky, the world's most cunning linguist, on neoliberalism and how Chris Hedges is saying that the right understands neoliberalism better than the left. And with the recent ruling with Alex Jones, you'll hear him talk about neoliberalism and corporatism and how the government works for corporations. Unfortunately, his solutions, like Glenn Beck, are in Reaganomics and pandering to evangelicals. And that is not that's what caused much of neoliberalism, not the solution. But it's the Democrats, too. Carter was on the Trilateral Commission. And you'll hear how Carter and other Democrats move toward the rich instead of the working class. So that part of what Alex Jones is saying is true. The other stuff he's completely bazonkers on. I used to listen to him when he broke into Bohemian Grove long ago. I think it was in the 90s or something, way long ago, is the only reason I even know who the guy is. So, yeah, Chris Hedges is saying, and others are saying, that the liberals need to understand neoliberalism much more. And I'm running into this myself. And we're coming up on the holidays here, so this is yet another installment of how to talk to a conservative. And what you want to do on the holidays with your wacky redneck families, I have them too, is we have common ground. We have more in common than we do with Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and the other multi-billionaires. You have more in common with the people at the January 6th insurrection than you do with the ultra-rich and the elite. So we have in common with the conservatives that we both, none of us want war. And they should be against corporations because corporations are not capitalism, no matter what they say. They might say that Adam Smith is an antiquated way of looking at capitalism, that now corporations are capitalism, but no one is supposed to be large enough to dominate the market. So no, corporations are not in capitalism. In fact, state sponsorship of corporations is the definition of fascism. It's socialism for multinational corporations. We know that Keynesian economics works. You know, if you don't want socialism, then provide some form of social welfare. Pay people the right amount of money and get them health insurance, and you won't have socialism. Keynes did this when business failed to maintain commerce and do the right thing with their workers and collapsed the economy with too much greed. The government stepped in with social welfare programs under Keynes, and this is proven to work. So if you don't want socialism, if you think you can do it with churches and private healthcare, go for it. I don't, it seems to me it would be better to pool your money in certain areas like healthcare and social welfare. It would be better to just pool your money with a tax and let some elected official that is under the eye of the public take care of those things and pool your, get a better price on stuff by pooling all your money together. But that's just me. And I kind of agree. I'm more of an anarchist. So I kind of agree that the problem with socialism is centralized power. So there's another agreement we have with the middle right is, we don't, centralized power is a problem. So, you know, an insurance pool, Medicare is more of a co-op, just like your credit union is a co-op that is owned by the credit union is owned by its depositors, and the depositors decide who runs the co-op. And when they're not doing well, they fire the head of the co-op. Just like health insurance, too, would be you pool your money together and it's owned by the people that use the service. So that's really not socialism. Technically, that's not socialism. And we can all agree that war is the way that the elite loot the treasury. They've done it for years. The money goes to blow up. Instead of going, right now you have inflation because instead of paying for things like healthcare and childcare and roads and bridges, we pay for bombs that are blown up. If you're going to blow something up, at least let's do the space program where you would actually learn something from blowing things up and sending things out into outer space. But no, they don't want a population that is that learns things and is intelligent, because they would make they would empower people and make decisions that would take the money away from the elite. So why did we have a 90% tax rate on the rich back in the before the Great Depression? Well, it's because they use the commons more than we do. They use the water, they use the roads. They can't get their workers to their businesses without the roads, the documents and licenses and contracts all need a common overseer, and they use those things more than you and me. War benefits the rich. Having a secure country, whether you agree, I don't really believe in war, but having a secure country benefits Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk more than it does you and me. So that's why they need to pay more taxes than you and me. And besides, if you read Gustavus Myers, and many people have corroborated this, most wealthy people have done something. They've cheated someone to get as wealthy as Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. They've cheated someone, and usually they're war profiteers. According to Gustavus Myers, he wrote the richest 500 people in America. Most of them were war profiteers, and that's how they had got an unfair advantage, and that is not capitalism. And they're usually performing illegal business practices like dumping. You know, you notice Edison and Tesla invented stuff. They did not. Tesla was a pauper when he died. Edison was not exorbitantly wealthy percentage wise. And look at all the stuff he invented. And you know, the rentier class don't produce anything. So we need land reform. We need to get land in the hands of the people, and not be paying rent to a class of society that does not produce anything. They don't do any work. They just hold land. That we can all agree on is a problem. And the financial class too, really just people that hold money and lend money and they aren't producing anything. And this is where I agree. The socialists have a great analysis of class struggle, but I don't agree with their solutions completely. For instance, a credit union, again, is owned by the depositors. Central banks tend to cause war and finance war. And those of you who have seen the musical Hamilton, you know, they also finance slavery, central banks. So beware of centralized power on all levels. I personally have a problem with. And I think it's South Dakota. One of the Dakotas has, and this is public banking, but these are only banks that only run the public services through their own bank. So they're not paying interest to a private bank. Instead, they have their own bank, and they don't have to use taxpayer money to pay interest to the financial class. So again, these are small, localized banks and credit unions that are owned by the people who they serve. Okay, so that's my spiel on, this is the problem with the definition of fascism is state-sponsored corporatism. And it is the families that want corporations just admitted you are a fascist. You're not, and that's fine if that's what you think, if you really think that that's the way to run things. with no competition and you have only one place to buy your goods and services, if you really think that's the way to go, then that's fine. But you are a fascist. And I think we can all agree that we need to get rid of corporations, and then we can talk about socialism versus capitalism. And by the way, rooftop solar, rooftop solar, rooftop solar. We don't need to pay a power company to run a line to your house. Okay, so coming up, Noam Chomsky, part one, with the Green and Red, from the Green and Red podcast, an anarchist podcast on how the Democrats have sold out the middle class, and we need a classless society, but not a class of just poor people and rich people. And so this is how the Democrats have destroyed the middle class, and where we need to join with the middle right and take power away from corporations. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media.
Thank you. People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental, and anti-capitalist politics. Brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Park.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red Podcast. I am Scott Parkin in Berkeley, California today.
And I'm Bob Bazanko in Houston, Texas. And we always begin by thanking you and want to do that again. We have an amazing guest today, which we'll get to in just a minute.
Yep. And if you like this episode, which we know you will because it's great and it's an amazing guest, go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit the donate button, or consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast.
Yeah, and check us out. We also have some books available for donors, and we're going to get some swag, some t-shirts and things too. So you can join the Green and Red community and become a comrade with us. Today, we are fortunate again to have Noam Chomsky on as our guest. And today we'll specifically be talking with him about the Democratic Party and the rightward shift in American politics. This is the 50th anniversary of George McGovern's 1972 campaign, which was a disaster for Democrats. And it really initiated a long rightward move for the Democratic Party, for American politics in general. And so we're going to talk to Noam about that. And we're going to start, he's going to talk with him talking about the 1972 campaign and how it led into Watergate.
Yep. So we'll be right back with Noam Chomsky.
He ran the most incompetent campaign that you can possibly imagine. Actually, I found out something about it just myself. It turned out that, I don't know if you recall, at the time there was a big flap about how Kissinger made a speech about how the war in Vietnam is all over, the U.S. is going to negotiate a way out, it's finished, forget the issue. It was all total lies, total. You looked at the facts, he was saying nothing except the war's going on. I happened to be in touch with Richard Goodman, who was a leading advisor to McGovern. And I asked him, why doesn't the McGovern campaign release this information? And he told me they didn't know anything about it. So he asked me if I could send him documentary evidence, which I did. And then McGovern had a press conference in which he quoted the documentary evidence, and he was asked to back it up. He had no idea. It was just a letter he'd gotten from me. So everybody laughed, you know. I mean, yeah. It was just unbelievable incompetence. And none of this was secret. And it went on like that. Of course, he was shafted by the labor leaders. They refused to support him. And it's worth remembering that there was no real opposition to the war among elite circles, Democrat or Republican. They'd go as far as saying maybe it's a mistake or something like that. But any actual opposition to the war, almost non-existent. In fact, decades later, can't find anything. It's you know better than I do. You look through the scholarly record, you can find people who say it was a mistake. Okay, like Russian generals in Afghanistan. Okay, it was a mistake. You can't find almost anything. Second World War. It's becoming very dramatic now with all the hysteria about Ukraine. So in fact, there's a marvelous article in Foreign Affairs by Fiona Hill, Angela Stent, the top liberal foreign policy analysts, highly regarded, and they're condemning the Third World for not joining in the U.S. campaign in Ukraine. And they say some of them even descend so low that they compare Putin's invasion to the U.S. U.S. efforts in Vietnam and in Iraq. I mean, you don't even know if you're living in the world. This is, it's not that there's anything secret about this anymore. Tons of material. But anyway, going back to McGovern, that's the background. He couldn't get any real support from liberal circles because they didn't agree with him.
This is a Green and Red podcast with Noam Chomsky. It's the 50th anniversary of the McGovern debacle and kind of the Democrats' drift to the right since then. So that's what we were going to talk about today. You were talking a little bit about the McGovern campaign, and you mentioned labor, because I remember AFL-CIO, I think, even refused to endorse them. But wasn't there also a movement within the Democratic Party by, you know, people like Jimmy Carter, in fact, to stop him, like kind of an anybody but McGovern movement?
Yeah. Well, Carter was, of course, pretty conservative. In fact, Carter administration was the last gasp of the Democratic Party to have any concern for the labor movement. It's one of the leading labor leaders, Doug Fraser, UAW, pulled out of a Carter-organized labor management conference, which was supposed to say how we will love each other and we'll work together. And he, which was Carter's view, basically. And he, Fraser made a very strong statement about how it's time for labor to recognize that business is fighting a one-sided class war to destroy the labor movement. And they've pulled out of the tacit compact of the last couple of decades to cooperate to create a better society. They're now just fighting a bitter class war, pulling out. The last gasp was the Humphrey Hawkins full employment bill, 1978. Carter didn't veto it, but he watered it down so that it had no force, just a voluntary agreement. He was quite anti-labor, and he laid the basis for the Reagan sharp escalation of the major class war, neoliberal assault. It's bedecked with all kind of fancy talk about markets, which is total nonsense, but it's just unrestrained class war. And Carter basically laid the basis for it. I should say that in Carter's later years, post-presidential, he's had a pretty good record. Mm-hmm. Not as president. In fact, right. He was part of the drift of the Democratic Party from in the 1970s to becoming what it now is, a party of affluent professionals, Wall Street kind of people who show up at Obama's fancy parties and Martha's Vineyard and so on, listen to Beyonce.
You weren't invited to his 60th birthday?
Not exactly.
So the 70s really is a pivot point. And I know there's recently some books on neoliberalism have come out, which kind of pin it on Reagan. But you really see this even before that. Carter was part of the Trilateral Commission. What do you think accounts for that shift away from the New Deal? Is it just kind of the global economy in the 70s starts to kind of contract, the aftermath of Vietnam? I mean, why do you think even the Democrats in the 70s said, OK, we're done with the New Deal. Now we're going to, you know, look for these solutions in the markets and elsewhere.
If we look back over a longer stretch, most of the business world, not all of it, but most of it was bitterly opposed to the New Deal in the 1930s. They basically had no choice. The popular movements were too strong. They had to tolerate it. But by the late 30s, they were already beginning, business campaigns were already beginning to try to undermine New Deal regulations, carry out what they called scientific methods of strike breaking, Mohawk Valley formula, all this kind of stuff. It was put on hold during the war, but immediately after the war picked up right away, passed hardly other measures to try to undo New Deal measures, but they were just too popular. You know, take Eisenhower. By today's standards, Eisenhower looks like a flaming radical. Yeah. Literally, he said anyone who questions New Deal measures doesn't belong in our political system. Anyone who interferes with the right of labor to organize is just too crazy to be in our political system. I mean, by now, that's the whole Democratic and Republican Party.
Yeah.
But the campaigns went right through the 50s. They couldn't make it too much support. Around 1970, the opportunities opened to really go full time. There was an economic crisis. Nixon's pulling out of Bretton Woods, Nixon shock, so-called. A lot of disruption, stagflation. You get to the Trilateral Committee report, which is quite interesting. This is Carter liberals, liberal internationalists, the Carter administration, mostly drawn from those ranks. Very important book, 1975, called The Crisis of Democracy. It was about what's called the time of troubles in the 1960s, when lots of people were getting organized and active, trying to press their interests and concerns in the political arena. The groups that are called special interests, like women, young people, old people, farmers, workers, in fact, the whole population. One group is not mentioned, capital, the business sector. They're not special interests, so we don't have to talk about them. They're the national interest. So we only talk about the special interests. And Trilateral Commission report says they're posing a danger to democracy. That's what the book was called, The Crisis of Democracy. All these special interests pressing for the demands, trying to enter the political arena. Too much pressure on the state, can't respond to them. So we have to have more moderation in democracy. They have to become more passive and apathetic and obedient and just let us smart guys run things. They were particularly concerned with the universities, which they said are failing, I'm quoting now, failing in their responsibility of indoctrination of the young. That's why you see these young kids out in the street protesting the war and calling for civil rights. And got to stop that business. Better indoctrination of the young. They were also concerned that the press is becoming too independent, may have to institute state measures to control them. This, incidentally, is the liberal side of the spectrum. You want to hear the hawkish side? Go to the Powell Memorandum to the Chamber of Commerce, same years. Basically the same measures, but much harsher. And also kind of insane. It was about how the business world is being destroyed by the radicals who are taking over the world. And Ralph Nader with his consumer protests, destroying free markets, Herbert Marcuse taking over the universities. I mean, it's kind of like you can kind of understand it. It's like a three-year-old who has everything, but somebody takes away one of the marbles he didn't notice, has a tantrum. That's the Powell Memorandum. We're losing everything because we don't control everything 100%. Well, that was influential, but the business activity. The Trilateral Commission is the liberal and a little bit softer in the rhetoric, the same policies. You take a look at the statistics, they're very striking. Around the mid-1970s, about 1975, you start getting the sharp split in economic statistics. So up until 1975, the period of so-called regulated capitalism, wage growth was following productivity, as you'd expect. US was pretty much within the range of other wealthy countries, OECD countries, and things like health costs, health expenditures, health outcomes, incarceration. By mid-1975, it all splits. The charts are very dramatic. At that point, the U.S. starts falling behind the other OECD countries sharply, in dimension after dimension. Well, that's the Carter preliminary to the, I mean, I don't blame him personally, it was the Democratic Party, which had basically abandoned the working class. They were, as I said, becoming the party of affluent professionals. But, and the Republicans, of course, just took off with it. The people behind Reagan understood very well what they were doing. First act, destroy the labor movement. Thatcher in England did exactly the same thing. That's quite important. That's the only means of self-defense of working people when you're going to carry out major class war. And then you go on with the deregulation, the massive growth of the financial industries, the bailout economy and crises, all the rest of it. And it's interesting, we've probably talked about this before, but there are actual measures of the success, great success of the class war, from the Rand Corporation, super respectable corporation, did a study of transfer of wealth in the 40 years since Reagan from to the top 1% of the population, $50 trillion. That's pretty impressive class war. And that's just the beginning. Reagan authorized tax havens, all sorts of devices to evade and to increase corporate welfare, even change the rules of corporate management so that a CEO could pick his own board to determine his remuneration. Guess what's going to happen? Shoots to the sky, carrying other managerial salaries with it. Business models imposed in universities, defunding of education, whole business goes on from there. Starts in the mid-70s, escalates under Reagan. That's what we have now.
What I find striking is that Watergate occurs in that Nixon resigns. Watergate blows up and Nixon resigns in 1974. And then the Democrats in 1976 and 1978 have pretty good elections. But by 1980, it's all gone. Like, how in such a short period of time did the Republicans recover from that? And how did the Democrats become, you know, so ineffective and weak in the aftermath of, you know, having virtually a veto-proof Congress with Jimmy Carter?
Well, I mean, two things happened. One, which was the main one, was the business world realized that the bars are down. The serious efforts they'd been undertaking, actually since the late 30s, to roll back any social democracy, to return to a corporate autocracy. By the 70s, the bars were down. They could go full force. That's why you see the very sharp changes in the statistical record right around 1975. Meanwhile, the Democrats had just decided we're not a working class party. We're affluent professionals, Wall Street donors, Clintonites, the rest of them. So there's no opposition. They could just, when Reagan came in, just go ahead full force. And that's what we've been living with for 40 years. That's why you see the anger, resentment, contempt for institutions, the whole society kind of collapsing. That's why you see a million deaths from COVID, worst record in the world, because the health system collapsed. Well, it started collapsing in the mid-70s. Go back to 1975, the U.S. health expenditures were roughly in the OECD range. Statistics, health outcomes were about the same. By now, the U.S. is just off the chart. Now, there's no other country where mortality is actually increasing. It's unheard of in the modern world. It's taking place in the United States. It's been increasing, for falling behind the rest of the world for some time. And now it's the only country where in the last couple of years mortality is actually increasing. Now you look at comparative records. Now the U.S. is doing worse than Cuba. I'm in a small country under brutal, vicious attack by the hemispheric superpower. It's got better health results than we do at a tiny fraction of the cost. Well, that's a pretty striking example, but it's going across the board. And it's, you showed us. I mean, one of the Financial Times editors, the main business journal in the world, pointed out, half a joke, that if Bernie Sanders was in Germany, he could be running on the right-wing Christian Democrat program, which is true. His policy, the policies he's calling for, is taken for granted in most of the world. Here they're regarded as so radical we can barely even talk about it. Well, that's what's been happening. It's the most effective case of class war that we've seen since the 1920s. 1920s, in fact, was pretty similar after Wilson's Red Scare, destruction of unions, destruction of independent thought, corporate sector going wild, huge inequality. I'm now back to my childhood.
Well, I think the parallel path of labor is really interesting here too, because they're kind of doing the same thing the Democratic Party is. I mean, you have these structural crises, and it seems like the inclination for everybody in the establishment is to go further to the right with them.
That's where the money is. That's where the power is. That's where the prestige is. So you want to fight against it, you get marginalized and vilified. You know, who wants that? It's much easier to go with the flow, live a comfortable life, be respected. And I mean, that goes right back through history.
You know, speaking of the sort of green and red, we often say that the Democrats, the centrist Democrats, punch left, so they go after their left flank. And we, you know, during the 80s and 90s, we saw them go after people like Jesse Jackson, Paul Wellstone, and more recently, Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And I'm just wondering, you know, how, you know, what your thoughts are on that.
Well, the Sanders movement is extremely important, including Ocasio-Cortez and others. They've mobilized a great number of young people to try to move the country towards some kind of social democracy. In most of the world, it's not much of a big deal, but here it's very important. It's worth remembering how reactionary the United States has become. I mean, like, take the word socialist. I mean, in most of the world, say somebody's a socialist is like saying he's a Democrat. It doesn't mean anything. Here it's a scare word. In fact, this goes pretty far back, I don't know if you recall, but in the 1960s, when SDS, Students for Democratic Society, was developing first major isn't movement, young people. Around the mid-60s, Paul Potter, who's the president, gave a presidential address. And his presidential address was about, it's time to name the system. We've got to be brave and courageous and be able to name the system, namely capitalism. He couldn't bring himself to say the word. It was too radical. You can't say the word capitalism in the United States. It's too radical. Okay, things have changed. Now you can say it. But socialist, impossible. Communist, hopeless. You know? The United States is very much a business-run society, ideologically and in practice, for many reasons that go way back. So a lot of what's just considered normal elsewhere is kind of way off on the margins here. You see it in policy as well. It takes something as simple as maternal leave, leave for women after childbirth. And the United States is the only country that doesn't have it, outside of a couple of Pacific islands. And nobody sees it, you know. And this is true on issue after issue. That's very much a business-run society. And sometimes it really goes wild, like in the 1920s, or since the Reagan period, for which the basis was set in the 70s. In fact, it's very striking to look at statistics of the kind I mentioned and see the very sharp break around the mid-70s, then, of course, extending under Reagan. It's dramatic.
I think that's an important period there, too, after Reagan, because you have, I mean, Democrats today still praise and seem to adore the Clintons and Obama, yet they all kind of very publicly said, you know, I'm not that far from Reagan. And especially with Clinton, you had the DLC created, so-called welfare reform, the crime bill, and then, of course, NAFTA. So isn't this like really kind of a huge transitory period in this move to the right done by these corporate Democrats, the DLC types especially?
Well, Clinton really initiated the period of corporate-run globalization, a form of globalization designed to undermine the U.S. working class and to enrich private corporations, which has been very successful in that respect. Corporate profits go through the roof. The working people are crushed. You know, lays the basis for Trump coming along and pretending to be the working class protector. Of course, shafting him in the back, though, stepping him in the back the whole time. But lays the basis for it. Democrats can't respond. What are they doing? Destroying industrial America in order to enrich private power. And of course, it's all supported by a cadre of economists who can, you know, prove some theorem that shows this is the best thing to do. Mostly jokes. But however, I think we should recognize it's changing. Take Joe Biden. Under a lot of popular pressure, a lot of it coming from the Sanders movement, Sanders himself, the domestic program of the Biden administration, to me at least, was surprisingly good. It was beaten down totally by 100% ironclad Republican opposition, a couple of right-wing Democrats. So it was all virtually destroyed. But the original program was pretty reasonable. That's the shift in American policy. And it could be a sign of a more hopeful future if the Democrats can become a party responsive to the interests and welfare of working people and the poor. They could. I think the Sanders movement is a sign of what could develop. But probably this won't happen. The Republicans understand it very well and are moving hard, not secretly, to make it impossible for democratic elections to take place, which is going full time right now.